You're listening to Root Cause Remedies, a show that explores environmental justice from right here in Hawaii. I'm Tina Grandinetti, and I'll be your humble host and fellow traveler on this huaka'i to learn more about the issues that affect the lands, waters, and people that sustain us. In the fall of 2019, the Kahuku community made local news headlines when they staged a month of nightly blockades to stop the transport of equipment to the Napua Makani Wind Energy Project. During that month, dozens of people were arrested. This would be the second wind farm for Kahuku, and these kia'i said that the industrial wind turbines were being built too close to their homes and schools, with the closest setback being the length of a single turbine. They'd been fighting for years to stop this project, following every procedural and legal avenue that they could, but the development was pushed through anyways. This week, we have the serious privilege of being joined by three Kahuku kia'i, Sunny Unga, Jessica Dos Santos, and Dr. Tevita Ka'ili. We sat down together virtually to talk about why their community opposed this project and what their struggle can teach us about the complexities of a just transition away from fossil fuels. And as you'll hear from our guests, the Kahuku Kia'i know that an energy transition is necessary and urgent because as a coastal community, they're bearing the brunt of climate change impacts and rising sea levels. This is an everyday reality for them. It's real and it affects their daily lives, but their experience has also taught them that renewable energy doesn't mean energy justice, and that if we expect this transition to be led by the same large corporations who've profited from fossil fuels and have gotten rich off of the destruction of our planet, then we're going to end up replicating the same kinds of problems that caused this mess in the first place. Last week, we talked about Hawaiian Electric, its monopoly over Hawaii's energy market, and the political power it draws from that monopoly. This week, we introduce another player, because while Hawaiian Electric runs its own power plants, it also buys power from independent producers. One of these producers is AES, a Virginia-based energy multinational that plays a big role in Hawaiian Electric's energy portfolio. AES provides a fifth of Oahu's power from its coal-burning plant at Campbell Industrial Park, and it operates a utility-scale solar farm on Kauai. AES is working really hard to secure its spot in Hawaii's changing energy market. Since the state announced its goal to move to 100% renewables by 2045, AES has been trying to brand itself as a leader in this green transition. And in the case of Kahuku, this means that they position frontline rural communities made up largely of kanaka and people of color as the people standing in the way of change. But despite all their talk of embracing renewables, 63% of the power AES generates comes from fossil fuels, and nearly a third is generated from coal, which is among the dirtiest sources of energy out there. The company runs coal plants in Puerto Rico, Maryland, and Oklahoma, but its big money comes from international projects. They operate in 14 countries and 4 continents. In 2020, AES earned spot number 28 on the University of Massachusetts Greenhouse Polluters Index and spot number 20 on their Toxic Water Polluters Index. And guess what? This kind of bad behavior has made AES big bucks. Globally, its assets are worth $32 billion, and much of that wealth is built on fossil fuels and extraction. So this is what the Kahuku community was up against: a powerful multinational corporate producer pushing an industrial scale energy project on a small rural working class community. Ultimately, AES did build 8 wind turbines in the Napua Makani project, but the Kahuku community won't stop fighting anytime soon. They see their battle as part of a much larger struggle for energy sovereignty for all communities here in Hawaii. And we're so grateful that they took the time to share their vision with us that we decided to turn this conversation into a 2-part episode, just to make sure you don't miss out on any of their brilliance. Hope you enjoy. Thank you again for agreeing to talk to us. Can we start with just each of you taking maybe just like a minute to introduce yourselves, where you're from, that kind of thing?
Sure, I'll go ahead and start. My name is Tevita Kaili. I'm a resident of Kahuku. I'm a cultural anthropologist by training. I teach cultural anthropology at Brigham Young University. I originally from Tonga and have connection to this place since the 1960s when my parents first came to school here. Been involved in many different social justice issues, but my main area of research is Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous culture. And happy to be here.
I'm familiar with your work, and I have gotten to learn some of it through like Kumunoi Noi. It's like really, really changed how I thought about a lot of things. So thank you for that. Who's next? Sunny, do you want to go?
Oh, I'm Sunny Unga. I'm a Kuku resident as well. I'm a social worker. Well, my background is in social work, so I definitely, you know, feel that like advocating for our communities and people is very important. And I'm a mother of three, and I am now a community activist in various different forms. So yeah, that's me.
Cool. Thank you. Aloha. I'm Jessica Dos Santos. I'm a educator in the public school system. I've been teaching history for the past 14 years in both the public and charter schools. I'm born and raised here in Kahuku, and I currently still live here in Kahuku. And I've also been involved in a handful of environmental movements, such as with Defend Oahu Coalition, trying to mitigate the impacts of overdevelopment, especially here on the North Shore, and more recently, part of our movement here in Kahuku to prevent the Napumokani turbines from going up.
Awesome. Okay, so I guess my first question is that a lot of people are familiar with Kahuku struggle, mostly through that stretch of like a month and a half or so where there were a lot of arrests and a blockade, and it was all over the news. But we also know that the struggle actually started long before that, and your community was trying for a really long time to stop this development or engage in the process before it got to that level. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the origins of the struggle, and then also just about what drove each of you guys to get involved.
I'll go ahead and start with that. About 10, 11 years ago was sort of the beginning of the struggle. Kahuku was cited as a place for wind turbines. And so there are, at that time, 12 turbines here at the Kahuku. Many of us, when we heard that there was going to be a second project of turbines, the additional turbines from AES on Napua Makani, decided that we've had enough. We have 12 turbines and we did not need any more turbines. So we started petitioning, protesting, attending hearings. You know, went all the way to a contested hearing on the habitat conservation plan. And so all of that was going on for many years before the October, November of 2019. And, you know, all of us were involved in that from the very beginning. So that's sort of kind of what happened. For me, my personal interest in this as a cultural anthropologist was to look at the impact on Opeapea, Native Hawaiians, hoary bats, and as a, you know, culturally significant winged creature for Native Hawaiians. And I saw the turbines of destruction destroying these important cultural animals. And so that's how I got involved in the first place.
Yeah, I can remember people like Kent Fonoi Moana in our community really raising awareness in those early years, even asking, you know, Defend Oahu Coalition for, you know, our support in really pushing to be opposed to this. And at the time, I think a lot of us were willing, you know, were willing to say, okay, it's too big and too close. And he had been fighting for, I believe, 1 mile setback from those early years, long time ago. We're still currently fighting for these setback regulations. And I have pictures that Dr. Ka'ili shared from like 2015 when we're, you know, holding signs on the side of the road in Kahuku saying, you know, too big, too close. So yeah, when it all came about again in 2019, we were quite disappointed that they had not heard us all of those years. Everything that we'd done, signing petitions and giving testimony and trying for setback regulations and just basically saying no the whole time. It was really very disappointing.
Can you tell us a little bit about like your personal motivations for joining in the struggle?
Okay, yes. Okay, first let me just say that, you know, we are for clean energy. We completely understand the dangers of climate change that are upon us. And we totally agree with getting rid of fossil fuels and things like that. But I personally wanted to just be with my community. In those early years, I wanted to stand up for my community. When community members were saying it's too big and it's too close, I was like, okay, well, can't they push it back farther? Right. And to be honest, I had thought it went away. I had thought that for many years I wasn't involved and I had thought that it was done. And then in 2019, we went to a fundraiser held by Keep the North Shore Country. And it was at this fundraiser where the community kind of became, you know, many of us became aware that, oh no, in fact, they are moving forward despite these legal cases, despite all of these years. Honestly, Mauna Kea really made a big impact on all of us. We had already by then been stuck to our social media, watching the live feeds, watching the talks from Auntie Pua and Ko'oka'i Kahi and Kalaikoa, and just really understanding that impact that they were having and making us all awake and aware that we need to take back our power. We need to become involved and stand up for what we believe in. And so at that 2019 fundraiser, I think blocking the road was mentioned like a dozen times. And it was our attorney, Lance Collins, who said, perhaps the Ope'ope'a, our ancestors, have come back to send a message to us. And, you know, the very next day we had just phone calls. All of us women just started like calling everybody and like, okay, so are we going to do this? Are we going to do this? And really we had 2 months from that fundraiser till the first night of transport, which was October 13th. Wow. And I don't know how we did it, but we somehow did it.
We're very glad that you did too. Sunny, can you tell us a little bit about your motivations for getting involved?
Yes. So I came a little after our fierce community leaders like Ken and Tavita, who have long fought, you know, even before. So I actually lived in town for many, many years. It was just convenient, yeah, closer to work and things, right? And so, but we made a decision that we wanted to move back to Kahuku, where my husband was born and raised, because we wanted to live in a place where there's a strong sense of community. And so I had no idea about all these turbine issues until a year after I came. I attended that same meeting that Jessica attended, and I became very concerned because I was thinking to myself, wow, we already have 12 and we're going to have more. And then the more I learned about this particular project and the more I researched and did my own studies behind, you know, the possible impacts that it could have on residents who live nearby, I became very concerned as a mother of three. You know, I'm thinking about my children and their health and how this could potentially impact our community and our families and our children. And so that's how I found myself getting involved. You know, one thing after another, I started going to public hearings and testifying. And then, you know, soon after, I'm finding myself at the BLNR meeting and then the PUC meeting. So just one thing led to another. And I just found myself just really advocating for equity and environmental justice for our community.
Awesome. Can you tell us, I know there are a lot of arguments against the wind turbines coming from many different angles. So can you kind of break that down for us? What were the community's main concerns about the development?
So I'll mention a few, and Jessica and Sunny can mention the other ones. I mean, the first one was just that, you know, we didn't have a voice as far as, you know, the construction of the turbines. We said no throughout the whole process. There was never an option for us to say no turbines. So we felt like that we were just going through the whole motion of the consultation process. And even during the consultation process, it was always about how tall the turbines, you know, or big or short, or maybe we'll move it back a few feet. It was never, we didn't feel like that our voice was heard at that time. So that to me was a, you know, an issue of environmental justice or, you know, or equity, because we were marginalized as a community during the process of consultation. So that was one of the main concern about the development. And then the others were a lot of environmental issues for us. For example, there was a lot of clearing of forests in order to construct the 8 turbines. Many of the lands here, even mounds that we have here, were basically just leveled in order to build the turbines. And then, of course, its impact on our, you know, avian species, both birds and bats. That was also a concern. And then the other ones was the health concern. And many of us were still trying to follow a lot of the scientific research at the time. And, you know, the science community were beginning to show that, you know, there are impacts as far as sound and others on the people who live close to the turbines. I think all of that were all many of the concerns that we had as a community relating to the turbines.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to what Dr. Ka'ili said, at that meeting, I was also thinking, wow, it seems really out of balance when we are trying to build something that's supposed to solve a problem, which could also possibly lead to extinction of entire species. What right do we have to build these large industrial things that could possibly wipe species from the face of the earth? And the more we looked into it, the more we realized how the opeopea and other avian species are extremely ecologically important. They act as natural insecticide. They help mitigate things in the natural environment, in the forest environment. They help with food production. They helped the Hawaiian people thrive here for thousands and thousands of years. And this is the reason why I think that cultures all over Polynesia revered the opeopea, because they understood they are so significant ecologically. They became an extremely significant part of the culture. The other thing is, you know, as mothers, to tell us that, oh, you know, like, don't pay attention to those other studies, listen to our studies. The more we did research, the more we realized we cannot just sit back. As mothers, we cannot sit back and not do anything to protect our community, even if their studies are right. Even if we find out that, you know, there are no, you know, long-term health, negative health effects, we are not okay with being guinea pigs, right? And so for us, it was a matter of, okay, we do not consent to be, you know, a scientific experiment. Shouldn't we know for sure if these things are safe before you put them near our community? You know, expose our children and our kupuna to 20 plus years of this, right? That's the thing about the studies that we've looked at, is that there's not a whole lot of long-term longitudinal studies. It's not like the turbines turn on and everybody dies. It's a long-term process where you're being inundated by these pulsating sounds, the infrasounds that is activating our, you know, stress receptors in our brains, the shadow flicker that could possibly trigger epileptic seizures in children. We're reading all of these things and to tell us, oh, no, you're going to be just fine. You know, mothers are going to be mama bears. We're going to stand up for our children. We're going to stand up for our community. And it just added more reasons on top of the reasons we already had to fight. And then there's the other thing, is that the more we found out about how illegal the project was, right, like how many times they had circumvented these laws, circumvented these regulations. And here we are, law-abiding citizens. We can't, you know, jaywalk and not get a ticket. And we try to follow the law. Like we're mothers and teachers and, you know, parents. We follow the law. Yet we found out that these large corporations are able to just drop millions and circumvent the process. And it's not fair. And it's not right. And so what we did throughout our fight is we stood up and said, no, the government needs to hold these large developers accountable to not only follow the law, but do the right thing, you know, for these communities.
Yes. And anybody who comes to Kahuku and looks at these turbines are appalled at the size, the sheer height and the close proximity that these turbines are to our children's school and our homes are, and so it's too big and too close. But I think what it really represents underneath the surface of all of this is the suppression and the total disregard for our community's voices, the concerns that we've had. And mind you, we've opposed this, you know, for 10 years. And a decade is a very, very long time for a community to oppose. And yet they were silenced and ignored during all these processes. Many issues that, you know, Jessica and Tavita had touched upon, you know, these developers being able to cut corners. And I think Napumukani is a prime example of the wrong way to develop renewable energy projects. And I think it really, really exposed the many flaws that our regulatory permitting processes and the system. You know, we're talking about what failed to happen at the Department of Planning and Permitting, BLNR, and at the BOE, and at the PUC, and at the city and the state level. You know, there were opportunities for these agencies to do something about this particular development and to say no to certain permits or to certain, you know, requests of these developers. And yet it bypassed all of them, you know. So there we see an extreme lack of transparency and accountability and a lack of meaningful community engagement in all of these processes. And through all of this, we learn that it's a top to bottom approach to decision making and a system that prioritizes corporate interest over communities. And, you know, we see how these community meetings and public hearings held by the developers or, you know, our government agencies, they really don't reflect the voices of our community. And I think that's the underlying issue. Had they listened to our concern and had they incorporated their decision making based upon the voice of our community, I think a lot of things would have been different, you know?
Yeah, I feel like I am hearing like there are specifics about the project itself that were issues for the community, like environmental concerns, cultural concerns. But then there's like the bigger question, which I feel like so many communities in Hawaii can relate to, of like corporations being able to railroad through their projects and with the, I guess, like arrogance that they can hold out longer than the community can, that they can put more resources in it than the community can and eventually get their way. The next thing I want to ask, and I think this is going to be a complicated question, but it's something that you guys were already getting to. What were some of the key points where the project went wrong or where you see the process went wrong?
Yeah, I think I'll just start with the, you know, it's very top down and colonial in the way that, you know, you have a corporation that's sort of acting like they own the place here in Hawaii. And I would say that that's where, you know, one of the main issue for many of us. They also had a lot of money. And so they used the money to almost sort of kind of like buy off people or say to them, you know, if you go into to this particular project, we will send you money for your nonprofit organization or so forth. Even when my wife and I, we had a contested court case, the CEO of the corporation at the time sort of pulled us aside and said, you know, how much will it take for you to back off of this case? Yeah. So they had the resources to sort of kind of, you know, divide and conquer the community in that way. And I would say that was just, I thought that was something that only happened in movies. I didn't know that actually happens in real life. Yeah. So it was sort of kind of divide and conquer approach that went wrong.
Wow. That must have been so confronting. Like, yeah. But then you also know you are pushing the right buttons if you get that kind of response.
Another thing that early on went wrong was the Public Utilities Commission at the time that they were considering the power purchase agreement actually approved it before the environmental impact statement was officially released. So they approved the project without having consulted the final EIS. So that in and of itself was wrong. It went to court. In addition to the BLNR decision, they used illegal dynamiting of, you know, the land. Yeah, in several occasions, they used dynamite in places that could have EV and they just used it and there were no repercussions. The Zoning Board of Appeals approved an allowance to have two of the turbines closer than are legally allowed to our residences. There's, I think, a farm dwelling that is like about 200 feet away. And when you think about the fact that we are going to have increased hurricanes, right? We're going to have increased extreme weather conditions happen because of climate change. These turbines are only able to withstand 90 mile per hour wind. And so our community was almost going to take a direct hit from Hurricane Lane last year. with 150 mile per hour wind. And so at that moment, we were all extraordinarily worried because our schools are right there, right under the turbines. Our residences are right there. And should anything drastic occur, we would have nowhere to go. We would have no safe place to run to except towards the ocean where we might have storm surge.
Wow, that's scary.
And even when we won our case, so we had a contested case in the Board of Land and Natural Resources, a contested case for the habitat conservation plan that wasn't really helping the bats. And we won that case. The hearing officer ruled in our favor. The Board of Land and Natural Resources overruled and went the other way. They didn't follow their own ruling. It was just, you know, the same board that decided that a telescope should go up in Mauna Kea that was also making the same sort of kind of decision for us here.
Right. And just to talk a little bit more about the PUC. So there was a motion for relief that was filed to pretty much asking the PUC to void the power purchase agreement based on the fact that, you know, they didn't have the permits that were necessary before they started their project. And, you know, they failed to consider the greenhouse gas emissions that is required by law. And then the rate that the commission approved was way more expensive. So it wasn't really there to benefit the public good. And so that was being challenged. And we actually broke the record and the highest submission of any docket to date. That was over 700 public comments in support of our attorney, Lance Collins. Even then, the PUC decided not to do anything about that. You know, I recall sitting in a meeting with the developers of AES, and the COO of Mark Miller was there. And one of the questions was posed to Mark was, is there any way you can build these turbines just a little further away from our community? And his answer was no. And the reason he stated was, it's just too expensive for them to build it further away. You know, from that meeting, you know, we just feel that their main priority and their main goal is to maximize profits for them, you know, and if that's going to cost money to listen to the community's request or concern, well, it's pretty much too bad, so sad, because we can do whatever we want. And the different agencies, you know, that we've talked about allows the developers to go ahead and do what they want instead of really advocating for the public and, you know, standing up for them. So, you know, we walked away from that meeting just feeling so defeated, right? You know, and then it just really hurts to hear, you know, whenever there's a news article or a highlight of what's going on in Kahuku, you know, AES says we are, you know, being good community partners and we're doing our best to maintain communication, when this is far from the truth. And it's just almost insulting that they would say that they're being good community partners.
I'm wondering if any of you kind of want to elaborate on the emotional toll that that takes, years of struggle to go up against a corporation, but then to also have these agencies that are meant to provide oversight or to facilitate or to make sure community voices are being heard, and then to feel like all of those different agencies were failing you.
Yeah, it does take an extreme emotional toll on especially the most disadvantaged and overburdened communities like ours, where we have a high level of poverty and we're mostly, you know, minorities here. And so I think it's generational pent up trauma. It's stemming from this same thing happening over and over and over again to Hawaii, starting with the overthrow. Like, it's just this trauma that continually happens to our people and to our communities, where we see the interest of these large corporations being put over the good of the whole and for the good of the people. And AES was just this shining example of how extremely unfair this whole system is in putting profits over people. And we see the environmental destruction that's happening with these large scale developments. Turbines are not as green as everyone thinks, right? And so I don't know if anyone has done the math in regards to, do these 20 years of energy consumption really balance out with all of the materials that have to be mined from the earth, that have to be produced using fossil fuels, that have to be transported using fossil fuels from thousands of miles away, you know, large amounts of concrete and steel and lubricants and fiberglass and all of these materials that have to be used? You really have to think, if we're using the same mentality that got us into this climate change problem in the first place, are we really actually solving the problem? And now we're seeing this happen with the use of our agricultural lands to place, solar panels on agricultural lands. It's almost like an insult when they say, we're really trying to solve climate change and we're trying to push forward with this clean energy initiative. But I see thousands and thousands of rooftops without solar panels, yet they're putting turbines and solar panels on our coveted agricultural lands. It doesn't make sense because the state is trying to double its local food production, but yet they're concreting over and putting panels all over our agricultural lands when there are rooftops that could have solar panels on them, that should have solar panels on them, parking lots everywhere. You know, whatever they're telling us, you know, we see these injustices where our community is overburdened with 40% of Oahu's wind energy production and rooftops go unpaneled. And Hawaii Kai has a lot of wind and they don't have wind turbines right behind their neighborhood, right? Not that we would want them to have turbines next to their houses or their schools, but we have to just call it like it is. Like, we know that that's where the money is. And so they're not going to put it there. They're going to put it into our community. And the larger picture is really not being looked at. Like, there's no planning in the Department of Planning and Permitting, right? Like, they're trying to build a radar system that would suck up pretty much almost all of the energy that the turbines are purportedly producing right down the road from us. And then they want to build a landfill in the back of our Kahuku Mountains, where possibly these large blades on these turbines are going to go into the landfill to desecrate the land. So it just doesn't make sense to us.
Right. And just to, you know, follow up with what Jessica had said, is that we really got to think about, what good would be reaching this 100% renewable energy goal when it comes at the cost of our valuable agricultural lands, you know, for food security and actual farming versus solar farms, right? And what good would these wind turbines be if we're driving our wildlife into extinction? You know, our ecosystem, you know, what a balance in our ecosystem is equally important, if not more important, in really combating climate change, you know, but we're destroying that in the name of renewable energy, you know, thinking that we're doing good and fighting climate change in the process. And, you know, what good would these renewable energy projects be when we're taking land that's supposed to be going to the Native Hawaiian community for housing? There's a lack of justice and equity. And like Jessica said, there's an unfair burden placed upon communities that lack the resources and the monies to really fight and advocate for their community and for their rights. And I believe that the Hawaii Clean Energy Initiative, you know, although their intention may have been good, but I think what we're now realizing is that it's just too narrow of a focus and it fails to consider the holistic, the system-wide view that is really necessary to effectively combat climate change successfully and to meet our sustainability goals while having resiliency in our communities. You know, it fails to integrate food security, agriculture, ecological protection, human health, Native Hawaiian rights, you know, and environmental justice. We need to change the system. There's a lot of things that we need to do to really, you know, engage the community in the process and do these renewable projects right in an equitable, just way.
Right. I couldn't agree more. It's that like siloing off of these separate issues when really like our whole system is off balance. I want to maybe backtrack a little bit and ask about part of the struggle that got a lot more attention, which was when you guys decided to put bodies on the line and put yourself between your home and the transportation equipment that was going to bring all of the materials to start construction. So you mentioned a little bit already, but when did you folks decide to take action? And maybe even more importantly, what did you learn from that experience? Also, I just want to make sure that our listeners have a sense of the scale of that blockade and how many nights it went on for and what it took to sustain it for that long.
So I want to backtrack and just say that all the struggle up to that point, the blocking of the road was the last resort, because mm-hmm. we were going through all the legal process, not only the legal process, but we were also dealing with multiple, you know, AES is the second corporation. There was a corporation before AES bought it from them. And they're the corporation that I talked to you about, who pulled me and my wife aside during the court hearing to say, hey, what will it take for you to sort of back out from this court case? So we were dealing with all of that and the many years. And so when Mauna Kea was going on, this is the time that we were starting to think, well, you know, we've exhausted all the legal avenue. We've all been good citizens. And it seemed to us that this would be the last resort for us. So it took a lot of planning. We were planning, you know, maybe a month or two before the actual day. And we were trying to learn as much as we can from individuals from Mauna Kea. We even had individuals from Mauna Kea who came and trained us. We didn't even know that there were different roles as far as, you know, people who were legal observers, and then there were people who were bail runners. I mean, all of these we were learning throughout the process, preparing for that. And we even also decided at the beginning who was going to get arrested and who was going to be doing all the different roles. We didn't know it was going to be 30 days. We thought it was going to be maybe just 1 or 2 days. And when it started, just started taking on its own life. We weren't sure if we were going to do the blockade at Kalailoa or in Kahuku. And so towards the end, we sort of decided that we were going to have two groups, one at Kalailoa and one at Kahuku. And that seemed to be what was going on. There was definitely the group in Kalailoa that was the big group that was there. But there was also another group in Kahuku. The first night, I think, was the night that everyone decided who was going to get arrested. The rest of them was just like people came on that night and felt like tonight will be the night I will get arrested. And so that's how it happened for the rest of the time. Even early on, we started talking with Waianae. And so they sort of kind of knew what we were planning and so forth. So they were in the plan from the very beginning.
The 2 months of planning was crazy. Like, we already weren't sleeping for 2 whole months straight. Like, not a lot of people understand how much planning and research we were really trying to do. Everything that should have probably been planned over the course of an entire year or more in a matter of 2 months. And this is all the while, you know, we're mothers and professors and teachers, like we have full-time jobs and we have families that we need to take care of. And yet we're planning, you know, we were sitting in people's garages, practicing duct taping ourselves in specific type of different shapes and arrangements. We were, you know, like, should we put towels over ourselves? But no, if we put towels over ourselves, they're going to think we have weapons. And then we had no idea beyond that first night that it would turn into what it turned into. And so when the first night happened, that was just an enormous amount of emotion and angst just all came out. I remember we weren't in Kalailoa the first night, but we were in Kahuku. And that morning when the turbines came, we had already been up for like a whole week straight, literally not sleeping because we had set up our camp. We had to try and organize who, you know, who was going to do what, who's going to feed at what certain time all the people. And to have, I think it was like 15% of the entire HPD force show up that morning was surreal. We had been going through so much trauma already that first week with having AES workers, you know, kind of bully us around a lot, push us around, having to deal with HPD and negotiate between HPD and AES and these workers. And it was like a nonstop 24 hours of just making critical decisions nonstop. When we saw that force come in, I mean, they had paddy wagons and the cars and the bikes and the motorcycles, and just hundreds of them surround us. There was a helicopter circling around. And here we have that first day, I think it was like 22 of our, you know, aunties and uncles, Auntie Margaret and Uncle Larry, you know, sitting with Hilif lay on their lap. And it was just amazing show of military force against these people who are just trying to protect their community and protect their neighbors and their family. And then it just kept happening night after night after night. And the beauty of how Waianae came out, one of the most beautiful parts of it all, I think, was seeing how they just knew. I think our friends asked them and they just immediately said yes, because they know environmental injustice. They have been experiencing this for years. And so they knew when they heard us, they knew exactly what was, you know, how it felt. And so it's the people that oftentimes have the least are the most generous and the most giving. They showed true aloha, like they showed the world basically, you know, they didn't have to do that for us. That's not their community, but they showed that they believe in true aloha for all humanity and to stand up together with their brothers and sisters. And we're just eternally grateful to all of the people who came. And it wasn't just from Waianae and Nanakuli. It was like people from all over, from, you know, town, east side, west side, wherever. Like people just felt it in their hearts that they understood the injustice that we had suffered. And, you know, the other part of it is unfortunately exposing how much HPD was really just a tool for protecting corporate interests. I'm a teacher and I had to go back to work. Like I couldn't, you know, continue the whole 39 days. And so I would go in and I had students like ask me, "Miss, is it true what the police chief said about you guys were violent and you were throwing rocks at the cop?" And I had to look them in the eye and say, "I was there. I was in the front of the line that night." They lied. The police lied on television about this. I mean, this just emotional drain and psychological pressure that's on all of us was just enormous. Unfortunately, I had to tell my students, you know, you do your own research. I didn't want to push them too hard, but it was just heartbreaking that I had to say, yep, they lied. We were peaceful. We were nonviolent.
I was super moved by the solidarity between Kahuku and Waianae too. And it made me think about how a lot of times in issues like this, something that is thrown at communities a lot is like, "You guys are NIMBYs, like not in my backyard." And that solidarity showed this isn't about NIMBYism. Waianae came out, it's not their backyard. It's about the injustice, like you said. That was super powerful to me.
You know, I just find it really interesting that, you know, this whole mass arrest of our community happened at similar time frames when there was a big TMT Mauna Kea issue exploding. And then there was a Waimanala folks with the Sherwoods, you know, and then you kind of come to see like the patterns, right? Like you kind of have to take a step back and see, hey, like what's going on over here? Like we're seeing a mass arrest of people of color, of indigenous people. Mm-hmm. What is going on? You know, and like you said, you know, a lot of people are quick to say, "Oh, you guys are NIMBYs." But my question to them is, does your community bear the burdens that we're being asked to bear? And if your community was asked to bear those burdens, would you be willing? You know, and my answer would be, I don't think they would be. And so we got to sit back and think, you know, what is all of this a reflection of? You know, it speaks volume of the injustices, you know, the unfair burdens that are placed upon our communities of color, indigenous people. And it's truly traumatizing for the community. You know, Jessica talked about the generational trauma and, you know, our community seeing their family get arrested, their mom, their dads, their auntie, uncles, the grandparents get arrested. You know, I have three children and you see how that impacts them. And then my children are young. So, you know, they sense what's going on, a lot of like anxiety and a lot of stuff going on within our community, but maybe not quite there to be able to process all of what's going on. So, you know, we've seen a lot of anxiety be expressed within our students and within my own children. You know, they would draw things, you know, about the turbines and what they're hearing in the media or what's being discussed at home about what's going on. And they're drawing, you know, drawing these turbines and these bats getting killed and us getting sick and things like that. And, you know, like when I see my daughters draw these things, and that's their way of processing all of these things, you know, it really hurts to think that our community is going through this emotional toll psychologically, you know, physically and emotionally. You know, we were still recuperating, you know, from this trauma because it's still ongoing. Our fight is still ongoing. There's so many different things. We just had a public hearing with the Planning Commission just last week to discuss the setback regulation, you know, and we have courts, you know, two pending litigations that are in the courts right now. And then we're being bombarded by all these other issues, the radar and with the landfill and, you know, many other things. So it's very stressful, you know.
Mahalo to Sunny Unga, Jessica Dos Santos, and Dr. Tevita Ka'ili. We're out of time for now, but they have a lot more to share, so don't forget to tune in to part two of this episode to hear the rest of their mana'o. And before you go, we want to let you know of a way you can support their fight. On Thursday, April 1st, Keep the North Shore Country are taking their case against Napua Makani to the Supreme Court. This case stems from BLNR's decision to allow the project to kill or injure 51 endangered Ōpeʻapeʻa over 21 years. Since everything's done virtually now, Kahuku folks are asking us to stand in solidarity by tuning into the live stream to show the courts and AES that the people are watching and that we'll hold them accountable. You can find the link to that live stream on our Instagram. And it's a super easy way to show your support and a great way to learn more about the kinds of processes that shape Hawaii's energy landscape. We'll see you in part two. Stay rooted.